Take a network break. Welcome to episode 39. Grab a coffee, a donut, and then join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks. And before we jump in, I just want to mention that this podcast is sponsored by the Open Networking Summit. ONS is pioneering SDN and NFV conference designed to foster a productive dialogue around SDN and NFV. It brings together the networking ecosystem of end users, engineers, business leaders, and researchers to discuss the possibilities and shape the future of the networking industry.
Where's it going to be held, Drew?
Greg, I'm glad you asked. Open Networking Summit 2015 will be held June 14th through 18th in beautiful Silicon Valley, California, and it features an expanded program of pragmatic SDN information. The focus of this year's conference is education, sharing of experiences, and best practices for the future.
Tell me more. What's going to be happening during the event, Drew?
Well, Greg, you'll get three keynotes, three panels, three plenaries, and nine tracks. And keeping with the open networking theme, ONS 2015 is going to emphasize all open networking projects. That means open daylight, open NFV, and open network operating system, ONOS. There'll be talks, developer tracks, and tutorials for each.
They'll probably give you a bag full of open as well. Like, if you got an open bag, would that have any more open in it, do you think?
You can fit so much into your open bag.
That's exactly right. Where can I go to sign up for this awesome conference?
If you want to sign up for this awesome conference, please go to www.opennetsummit.org. And if you use the discount code Packet Pushers in all caps, you can get a 15% discount on registration.
That sounds pretty awesome.
All right, and on to the news. So this has been the week of acquisitions, starting with some consolidation on the silicon front with Avago to buy Broadcom for $37 billion.
Yeah, this is pretty interesting in a way. Most of us in the networking industry will know, of course, that Broadcom is famous for its silicon that's been used to make Ethernet NICs for the better part of a decade, and more recently it's been making silicon for switches and leading the charge into white box sort of stuff. And now we're looking at it from the point of view of how are we going to be able to, if Broadcom merges with Avago, what does that mean for us? Which is pretty interesting stuff. Avago, of course, is a company that makes network silicon in itself. It has a range of chips. And the most people I've seen talking about this so far, not that I know too much about it, but the general consensus is that it's about being able to do all the things. That is, if you're going to be a silicon manufacturer, you need to be putting together a package of stuff that is actually, you've got to have a full spectrum of capability. So it's not enough just to have CPUs or to make a chip here or a chip there. You've got to be able to do the entire package that the people want. You can't just say one thing or the other. So consolidation, convergence, all that sort of stuff.
So there was also a story about Intel nearing a potential $15 billion deal to purchase Altera.
Again, Intel is one company that's shown that if you're going to make silicon, you need to bring the whole thing together at scale. You can't just make the chips on their own. You need to be putting together an entire package of capability. And so what Intel's doing is buying a silicon company that sits next to. The unique thing about this is that Intel's a pretty big company. I think it's like a $60 billion business. And so it'll be their single biggest acquisition ever. And a lot of people are going, why does Intel need to have that $15 billion purchase? But again, the silicon business, making silicon chips, is a scale business. You've got to be the biggest and the mostest in the to be able to extract value from the whole game. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're Avago and you complement Broadcom, like a lot of what they have is they overlap in different spaces. So Avago doesn't have too much networking silicon, but they both compete in wireless stuff. So 4G base modems and all that sort of stuff. And Broadcom recently sold off its 4G baseband modem chips and its 3G modem business. And there's a whole bunch. But the answer is you can't just have a CPU chip, a memory chip, a bus chip like the old Intels, they all converge into one SoC, so system on a chip. So today you can buy an entire Intel server on one chip and put it into a NUC and buy it for $300. And that's what's happening with all the other chips. So smartphones used to be made out of dozens of chips. Those chips have all steadily shrunk down into one chip. And so if you're a company like Avago or Broadcom and you suddenly everything's shrinking, you've got to move to get the pieces of silicon design that you don't have.
So you're seeing this instead of, like, sometimes companies will merge because of overlap, and then they can sort of reduce those inefficiencies of each having competing products and just go one direction, or they're buying themselves into a market that they don't necessarily play in, and you see this as the latter.
No, it's a bit of both. So Avago and Broadcom is very much about these two companies have some complementaries and some overlaps. That means they can reduce R&D on the overlaps because competition is about duplication most of the time. So the companies duplicate each other's efforts. So if you can merge together, then you don't have to both reinvent the same wheel.
Right, you get some efficiencies, yeah.
You get some efficiencies, but there's also some things. But more importantly, the chips that Avago has that Broadcom used to have that used to be two different chips are now merging into single chips. So you're better off to merge the businesses together and make the chips as one thing. We're seeing this, and we'll talk more about this with a range of acquisitions in a minute. Hyperconvergence does the same thing. So that is the days of buying a server and a storage and a network and an operating system and a hypervisor as separate things is going away. As hyperconvergence says, and this is led by companies like Nutanix and VCE and those types of things, you just go and buy one thing from one company and it does all those things and forces the convergence. So the trend is that everything's shrinking down into one thing. So instead of a server needing a network separately, the server and the network come together with the storage, with the hypervisor, all built into one thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's what's happening to silicon, right?
Yeah. All right. Yeah, we've talked about Broadcom and chips a lot. We'll keep looking at this.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's just big, big money. Like, these deals are huge. Avago is buying Broadcom for $37 billion, and Intel's spending $15 billion here to buy Altera. It's a rumor, by the way, that it's not spent yet, but that's what the deal is supposed to be happening. So pretty amazing stuff.
One little side observation about the Avago to buy Broadcom deal. I was reading a Forbes article about that. It looks like it's going to be more like a merger, the way the Forbes article interpreted it. It sounds like a buy, but it looks like a merger. It's going to be Broadcom Limited when the deal is done. And the two guys that started Broadcom are taking – it's like they're getting – it's a buyout for them. It's their exit strategy. They still have a role in the company, but it's very much reduced. One of them is going to be the CTO. One of them is going to be on the board of directors. And they're billionaires now out of this whole thing. But it's still retaining the Broadcom name, which I thought was interesting because since Avago seems to be the aggressor, but the acquirer in this case. So be curious to see what the emphasis of the chips are and the branding when the new company emerges.
I think Broadcom's got a better brand name in the smaller end of the market. Because they've been making Broadcom NICs for so many years or Broadcom modems for mobile phones. Mm. Whereas Avago's very much been one of those companies that if you're in the business, you know who they are. And perhaps that's why they're choosing the Broadcom name, so they've got a brand to build off if they want to get into the, you know, start making. I mean, we're already seeing this with merchant silicon in networking. We talk about, oh, this switch has the Broadcom silicon inside. Well, that's branding right there. Mm-hmm. So if Avago, you know, if we suddenly had to rename it from the Broadcom Trident or the Broadcom Strata DNX or the Broadcom Tomahawk to the Avago, that would be lost. So you'd rather go with the one that's, you know, better known or more widely known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basic marketing.
Today, we don't know the brand name of the carburetor inside your car. That's because the car manufacturer just makes the carburetor as part of the engine. But there was a day when there were companies who made Weber carburetors and you'd buy the Weber brand name.
Right.
Yeah, those sorts of things. So Convergence.
All right. More acquisition news this time in the cloud. EMC is buying VirtuStream for $1.2 billion. And VirtuStream is essentially an infrastructure as a service player, but they specialize in hosting SAP applications. So they're not competing with the likes of AWS and Azure.
Yeah, that's right. They actually are a cloud provider in their own right, but that's not really their core value, as I understand it. I had to spend quite a bit of time reading it up. Hopefully, I'm going to get this right. Chad Sakic from EMC, writing on his blog, which is a EMC marketing space, has a very good article up about it. It sort of explains it. But VirtuStream is a cloud provider, but specializes in taking your existing on-prem apps and then moving them into a managed private cloud, or in the public cloud, off-premise managed private cloud. So what VMware has been able to achieve as part of their vCloud Air, or whatever it's called this week, platform is you go and move your stuff into their cloud, their public cloud. VirtuStream actually provides the software that allows you to migrate. So it's kind of another take on the hybrid cloud. That is, I can build a private cloud on somebody else's infrastructure in somebody else's data center, but I don't have to change anything about my app or my network to get to that app. Right. So it's still off-premise, but it looks like it's in my data center.
Yeah, it's like a managed services play, but with more cloud goodness added.
It's sort of. It looks like managed services. In fact, VirtuStream might sell well to managed service providers. those people who like have very limited skill sets in their own right and are happy to waste, you know, happy to take a 20% margin and then give the rest to the vendors, sort of thing, instead of actually building their own skills and going for a 60% margin like Amazon's doing. And so that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Just one snide remark here is that they talk about the Federation family. All of the brochures talk about the EMC Federation family, and it's sort of, you know, what's the Star Wars? It's like, you know, the evil empire is the Federation or something, isn't it?
Well, Star Trek has the Federation, which is the good guys. So maybe they're doing a little Star Trek branding there.
Star Wars has the Empire.
Star Wars has the Empire and the Rebel Alliance.
You will join the Federation family. It's going to be great. Yes. No, in the Federation family, we love you. You don't love us. It just seems like it's very, like, creepy, but there you go.
The prime directive of the Federation family is to buy EMC.
Interesting thing about this, of course, is that now that they've got a hybrid cloud solution, this puts EMC on equal footing, I think, at first glance, with Cisco's InterCloud and HP Helion. So both of those strategies are about propping up sales of hardware, that is servers going out the door. So InterCloud is about propping up UCS sales and the networking stuff that Cisco does. And for HP, HP Helion is about continuing to own software and to sell servers and manage services contracts. And so they have the hybrid cloud capability there for customers who want to have that type of capability. So this puts EMC back in that play. So that is, they're growing their cloud capability. Of course, they acquired OpenStack company recently. I can't quite remember the name of it off the top of my head, but there was a cloud scaling, which is an OpenStack provider. And so this is going to be interesting to see how that plays out, because then EMC, HP, and Cisco can all go head-to-head on managed private clouds on public cloud infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely puts EMC in a, I think, a pretty good position, and with a strong a distinguishable cloud line. It's not just about VMware anymore.
No, it's not just about VMware, which is interesting, but also that EMC is only one step away from selling servers directly to compete with other people.
So more acquisition news. We warned you this is the week of acquisitions. HP is buying an NFV company, a startup called ContextStream, and they are an NFV company.
So HP has a very strong story in network functions, virtualization, and SDN. They've been a big contributor to the Open Daylight. So if you're into open standards, HP's been working along Open Daylight. They've recently got into white brand switches and open, so they're very open-ish, if they like that sort of attack at that market. And they've recently been tagging onto their existing service provider strategy. So HP already has a business unit which is very strong in selling their HPUCs and a bunch of software and a bunch of managed services to service providers to manage networks. Well, not so much the networks, but the infrastructure, the software that sits above the network itself in the billing and accounting sites and the OEM systems. And so it makes sense for HP to own the software between those OAM systems and the network itself. Interesting to note that I'll refer you to a blog by Tom Nolley from Simi Corporation, who's an analyst in this space, and he basically points out, and correctly I think, that ContextStream is an over-the-top NFV play. That is, some companies are trying to make NFV in the network, so that is, you use network hardware to deliver network functions virtualization. Talk more about that in a second. But HP is very much about doing it over the top of your network, so you don't have to change your network or modify your network. You can add this on top of your existing network infrastructure. It uses Open Daylight. HP is very big on pushing Open Daylight and open standards, so ContextStream seems to make a very good fit.
Yeah, I would say so, and I thought it was interesting that it's an Open Daylight play. I don't have a sense of how much the carrier and telco market is looking at Open Daylight. I don't know if they're trying to rule their own, but the fact that that HP is pushing Open Daylight toward the carrier market, I thought was interesting.
Well, there is interest in the carrier market for Open Daylight, but it seems like a lot more service providers are beginning to talk about ONOS now, the Open Network Operating System, and that controller and that platform. Another thing that's interesting here, if ContextStream is an over-the-top NFV play, that begs the question, well, what of the silicon folks that are aligning themselves to deliver NFV in silicon, so that you can, the idea being, well, x86 is wonderful, you can do a lot with it, it can scale to a point, but what happens when you need to scale beyond that with your NFV? So I was briefed by ARM recently, and that's one of the things that they're talking about. They are working with the OPNFV project, for example, and working on how do we as an industry get to a point where we can abstract whatever the underlying silicon is that has hardware capabilities that allow us to scale NFV operations very big, which is a question service providers are asking. There's got to be different perspectives within service providers about how they're actually going to deliver NFV at scale. And I'd love to hear all those. There's really two different camps now. I mean, we're talking about an over-the-top play. We're talking about just x86, commodity hardware. Slam as many in there as you need, deliver. And then there's still silicon providers going, yeah, but you got to accelerate, and we can make chips to do that. And isn't that a good idea? It'd be interesting to see industry reaction on this deal.
That, you know, the over-the-top says, importantly, means you don't have to change your network to add NFV is kind of the story. Whereas other people are saying, oh, no, you've got to use... We recently published a podcast last week with some of the guys from Cisco talking about network services headers. That was Priority Queue 50, was it, Ethan?
It was 50, yeah.
Yeah, Priority Queue 50. I'll put a link into the show notes. And Cisco, this is one of Cisco's strategies where if we're going to put an MPLS tag in that tells us path information, why don't we conceptually, this is not exactly how it works, but this is for a very quick description, what if we made the MPLS tag 120 or 196 bits long, and then into there we packed in a whole bunch of metadata about the service that it's actually using? Well, now I can start to route packets through the network by inspecting this network services header to say in the NFV, oh, it came from here, now it goes to there, and it belongs to this service with this billing tag and a whole bunch of other metadata carried in the tag. So this means that the network needs to be intelligent enough to know and to recognize this network services header. So your forwarding plane, like when MPLS was introduced or VLANs, where VLAN tags were introduced, your hardware has to support these features. And I'm not necessarily convinced that that's the right solution overall, that that's one way of doing it in the network. The network knows about it. The devices all participate in the forwarding. The other way is to just do overlays over the top and then have the state programmed into the flow table to say this source to this destination follows this path. Boom, away it goes.
Well, again, if it's a question of scale, and let's assume, I'm not saying this is fact, but let's assume the only way you get scale is within hardware. I agree, you still got the problem of dealing with that hardware, and the answer seems to be abstraction layers, where everyone's writing to a common code base, and then there's an abstraction layer that takes care of making that code work in whatever the underlying silicon happens to be, which is another interesting question, because then doesn't that take away the significance of the silicon underneath to some degree?
I think so. I think like Intel, so I look at Intel servers and, you know, Windows and Linux both use whatever hardware Intel makes available to them. And Intel continues to add new silicon features into the CPU constantly, or add new silicon advances in the bus architectures or new connectors, you know, like USB 3 is better than USB 2 and so forth. And yet the operating systems are easily able to adapt, and sometimes they need hardware things like the DPDK extensions, which do network acceleration. Mm. They require specific hardware on specific models of CPU. There's not much you can do to remove that, but as operating systems iterate, they get onto the new silicon features. There's advantages and there's disadvantages.
OpenFlow with table type patterns is kind of in that world now. Yep, we know there's going to be different silicon features underneath, and you can use table type patterns to determine what we're going to actually talk about and do, which means you can announce from your silicon effectively, these are the things I'm going to do, and implicitly then what I can do at scale.
And Open Compute for their switching operating system are talking about a switch abstraction interface, which is a software shim that sits between the silicon underneath and the software over the top, so that you can make function calls using standard APIs no matter what chip is underneath. So whether you're using an Easy chip or a Centec or a Broadcom, you know, Tomahawk, it's all the same. The operating system doesn't have to change.
I mean, this is the game that we always see, though. It's you know, here's my special hardware silicon that's going to do amazing things for you, and then, you know, the general purpose chips catch up and provide the cost value, and so we always get this push and pull.
bringing it back down to Contextstream just for a minute, I mean, I've been briefed by them a few times, and my recollection was they have a customer base. So HP didn't just buy technology. They bought some amount of customers as well. Service providers that were using Contextstream, they weren't huge, but someone was out there already doing proof of concept and making that solution work. So it's probably got some legs.
Yeah.
All right. We'll keep an eye on Contextstream. Continuing with the flow of acquisition news, Fortinet, a maker of hardware and virtual security appliances, is buying Meru Networks, a WLAN vendor.
Yeah, I don't want to make too much out of this. Fortinet, in my view, has a history of buying smaller companies, often companies that are under some sort of financial pressure and reaching the end of their run. Meru Networks has been a fairly successful wireless vendor, but hasn't sort of broken out like Ruckus or Aerohive or Aruba compared to them. And so Fortinet's doing its usual history of buying a smaller company that's in some distress and then leveraging them to bring them to market. So that's how Fortinet got its hardware. It bought a couple of other companies to bring together to make hardware-based firewalls. So I would expect Fortinet to produce a line of extending its firewalls into the wireless, which is roughly equivalent to Aruba extending its wireless into the campus and also now has its own firewalls too. Remember, kids, there is no standard for firewall. Anybody can make one and call it one.
That's right.
There are no, you can make anything and call it a firewall. There is no definition. There's no section. There's no standard. There's no RFC for the word firewall.
And I think it's also just a sign of the continuing consolidation in the wireless LAN market. Cisco bought Meraki, Meraki, HP bought Aruba, now Fortinet and Meru. And before that, we had Extreme and Enterasys getting together, essentially because Enterasys had a nice wireless play that was a good fit for Extreme.
Yeah.
So it's getting hard, I guess, lonely to be a standalone wireless vendor now.
Hmm. Also worth remembering that the whole wireless market was built on merchant silicon. They all had their own. We're all using merchant silicon chipsets. Their only differentiation was in the software and their radio antennas, by and large. There were a few who made their own chipsets, but they were very rare.
Mm-hmm.
Just in case you missed it, a lot of people don't know that.
Okay, carrying on. Palo Alto Networks buys Zero Secure.
This week in buying something. Just from a change. I have no idea what Zero Secure is, but I thought that we just should point out that firewall companies buying something or another is a thing. Zero Secure is about extending their firewalls into SaaS. Now, I wrote a blog post this week called just today as to why firewalls are not going to be the future of the data center. And this acquisition plays directly into that argument because the idea of firewalling stateful or the idea of firewalling by doing deep inspection is dying because once encryption comes along, and I'm seeing reports saying that 80% of all internet traffic will be encrypted by the end of next year, a firewall will be no use. Everything will be HTTP, HTTPS, and the only thing you're going to see is a URL. So your only security strategy going forward is to start having deep granularity and inspection by analyzing the packet flows, like not just a packet, but the actual flow, building metadata and recognition systems and heuristics engines that can actually fingerprint a flow over hundreds or thousands of packets to say, this is Google Drive or this is Box or this is Dropbox, and then being able to apply security policy to that. So firewalls are dying and being replaced by these security data theft engines, I guess, or better, or security inspection engines. And that's what this is.
You don't see folks continuing to just decrypt, inspect, and then pass on the traffic. You think it's...
You can't decrypt if you don't own the private key, and you don't have the private key to Google Drive or Box or Dropbox. You can't decrypt that.
Okay, that's interesting.
In certain enterprises today, you can, because the desktop has it actually forms an SSL connection to the proxy server, and the proxy server then presents its own certificate off to Google and Box.
Okay, so then you can see the traffic.
So then you can see the traffic and you do the decryption. But those boxes are built on the assumption that you can decrypt about 5 to 10% of your traffic. When 80% of your traffic's encrypted, those boxes are going to need to be very, very big, one. And two, what we're already seeing, so for example, Instagram, if you try to use Instagram through a proxy, it actually fails and says you can't do this. That's why Instagram, for example, doesn't work on various Wi-Fi hotspots who run you through a proxy service so they can log your traffic and see, then get metadata about their customers. And so Instagram's stopping that because they want to sell that data. They don't want to do one of two things. Either they don't want to sell your data, or they want to sell it instead. One of the two. Protect your privacy at the same time. So no, you can't. The switch will come in the next year or so when people like Google say, if you're coming through a proxy server, we'll block it.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that too. That comes to the end of all our acquisition news. if that wasn't enough for you.
Thanks for that. It must be like, is this like acquisition week in the business or something? I'm not sure.
I guess folks had a lot of money sitting around burning a hole in their pocket.
Well, they do. If there you read the financial news, they say that a lot of the American companies, as the U.S. dollar gets stronger and stronger, the money that's offshore is worth, you don't want to repatriate it. Two reasons. One is the money that's offshore is getting less and less against the dollar. And two, they have to pay tax on it when they bring it back. Mm-hmm. So if they can buy offshore companies, they get good value for money. And second, they can take a loan against it and then use it to buy stuff in America. And one day they reckon they'll pay it off. So there's a whole bunch of financial engineering going on. Yes, a lot of companies have a lot of money, so these purchases make sense.
All right. So my virtual coffee is finished. Guys, are you done?
Nearly. One of the things about this is that with all these acquisitions going on, Cisco and hasn't done anything. I just wonder what Cisco's going to do in reaction to these. Cisco doesn't have many gaps in its portfolio, and of course we talk mainly talking about networking. And as you know, Cisco goes horizontal into storage and servers and virtualization with its OpenStack products and so forth. These acquisitions, some of them start to attack, you know, what Cisco's doing with the SourceFire acquisition, with its intercloud initiatives, and, you know, those types of things. So it'll be interesting to see what Cisco does. They've, in their financial results last quarter, they hinted that they weren't likely to do too many acquisitions as they didn't see anything that they wanted to buy. And I wonder if all these other acquisitions will change their mind and say, you know, if everybody else is going to do something, maybe we should too.
But I sort of wonder, I mean, Cisco recently bought Embrain, which does, you know, virtualized functions as firewalling, load balancing, and they bought TLF a little while before that, which is essentially a service orchestration company aimed at telcos. I guess my feeling is that the HPs of the world are reacting to Cisco rather than Cisco feeling like, what do we do next?
Yeah, I agree with that point of view. That's what I'm saying. I wonder what Cisco will do. I don't think they'll race out and buy something. I don't believe that they see anything that's worth doing. The other thing, too, is you've got to remember, like, HP bought ContextStream in the NFV business unit. Mm-hmm. And Embrain was bought by the ACI NCEMI team, that business unit in the data center. And TailF was bought by the service provider business unit inside of Cisco. So it's not like they were all bought and mashed together. They're all different companies inside of the bigger company.
Yeah, definitely different plays.
Definitely.
But, yeah, it seems like ContextStream is HP reacting to TLF and wanting to have a stronger position to say to carriers, mm-hmm. hey, we can play here too.
That's a good point of view. I hadn't thought about that. That makes sense. I think the overall thing is that everybody's increasing their cloud footprint. The recent announcement of Amazon's numbers, I think Chad Sakic in his blog post said the thing that shocked him about Amazon wasn't how big it is and not how fast it was growing, it was how much money it was making.
I got people saying, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah. I've said that a few times in the past is that Amazon's making a lot of cash. Amazon's AWS is making a lot of cash. It's just interesting that a lot of these are all about cloud. So the Palo Alto acquisition is about SaaS or cloud services. Mm-hmm. EMC is about making sure that people don't leave their private clouds and go into public clouds. We're going to get them halfway and trap that revenue inside of the Federation family. Horse head on the bed. And the other
I've
one
never
is
heard a slant on the Federation being evil. That's great. Trekkies are scratching their heads right now. But anyway,
it's that phasers to lock in.
It takes a certain type of person to make the Federation evil.
Set phasers to lock in. I love it.
Oh, that's dreadful. Lee Good.
All right. We have links to all these stories, plus some blog posts for additional content in the show notes. And Greg, where can folks find you this week?
People can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitters as @etherealmind.
Ethan, how about you?
EthanCBanks.com is my blog, at ECBanks on Twitter, and some of my thoughts on these things will show up in my newsletter, The Hot Aisle, which you can find on my blog.
Fantastic. You can also find me on the Twitters at @interop_Andrew, and please do leave notes or comments, and you can also find this on iTunes, download it. And please, if you are interested in open networking, don't forget to check out our sponsor, the Open Networking Summit, at opennetsummit.org.